The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Ross, Judge Bjorkman, Judge Bryan, the Honorable Kevin G. Ross presiding.
Good morning, everyone. I can see you. I hope you can hear me. Welcome to the Court of Appeals for this July 29 panel. There's nothing wrong with your computers. You are not seeing Judge Bryan for a reason. He actually has a bit of a family emergency this morning that keeps him away from the panel. He will, however, be participating in the case, even though he won't be asking questions today during the oral argument. He'll have the opportunity to hear the oral argument and will fully participate in the decision in the case. I should just state for the record, as the parties are, of course, already aware, but for the record, the Court of Appeals is declining to hold oral arguments live at the Minnesota Judicial Center here in St. Paul today and in other courtrooms around the state as well. And we're doing so out of concern for the public, the parties, the attorneys, and court staff in light of the ongoing emergency arising from the pandemic. We're engaging in this oral argument by a WebEx, a video platform that is imperfect. So, counsel, please be aware that there may be times where either your voice or image is, for lack of a better term, glitchy, and it may be the same with the court. So if you're having any difficulty at all seeing or hearing either of the judges or each other in the case, please just alert us and we'll pause and make sure the technology is up to speed and everyone can participate fully as if we were live. Please do state your name as you commence each leg of the argument. You will have 15 minutes for your argument, just as if we were live, with an additional 5 minutes to appellant's counsel if you choose to use that time for rebuttal. And the last thing I will mention is, already covered it, so we're in good shape. The first case on our calendar this morning is State of Minnesota versus Beasley. Counsel for appellant, whenever you're ready to proceed, you may.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. My name is Leah Graff. I represent the appellant, Davion Beasley Sr. in this matter. In this felon in possession case, Mr. Beasley asked this court to reverse his conviction because the state failed to prove beyond a reasonable doubt the element of ineligibility when it failed to prove that Mr. Beasley was the subject of a prior juvenile adjudication for a crime of violence. Alternatively, Mr. Beasley asks the court to grant him a new trial due to the district court's erroneous denial of instructions on self-defense and necessity and due to prosecutorial misconduct when the state referred to facts not in evidence in closing. I want to note that Mr. Beasley's brief raises one other sufficiency claim. It's the first issue in the brief. Given the Minnesota Supreme Court's decision in State versus Roberts, that opinion is dispositive here, so I don't plan on addressing that issue this morning. Where I do want to start is the district court's denial of the jury instructions. The district court here very clearly weighed the evidence, made credibility determinations, and otherwise failed to view the evidence in the light most favorable to Mr. Beasley. That the court must do that is very clear from the law. And we know that the district court didn't do that in this case because of what the district court didn't say and what the district court did say.
I'm sorry, Ms. Graff, can I take you completely off the rails and have you focus on a different issue in your brief, which is the sufficiency of the evidence? I'll ask the same thing of the state, but I was curious as to why you believe that we should be reviewing the sufficiency of the evidence based upon a direct evidence standard rather than a circumstantial evidence standard.
Well, I think that is a fair question, Your Honor, and I think that the type of documentary evidence that we have here is typically the type of evidence that serves as direct proof of a fact.
Well, it's direct proof that the person who is named is the person. But in this case, I thought your position was that it could be naming someone else because it identifies someone of a name that is not of the same name as your client. I guess my question is, don't we have to infer that? I mean, that the I don't know if it's pronounced Shade or what the name is, but don't we have to infer that the person named is Mr. Beasley?
So I think that under either standard, if the court's applying a circumstantial evidence test, then yes, then there is a question of what are the circumstances proved and were there any other rational inferences other than guilt. The name in the exhibit is pronounced Shrady, and I think that the question then becomes, is there any rational inference other than Mr. Beasley's guilt? And the answer to that is yes. There are certainly rational inferences that this person named in this adjudication is perhaps a relative, a son, a nephew. It's not uncommon for families to use, similar person.
Before we talk about what inferences might be rational, what would you identify as the circumstances proved? In addition to the document, what were some of the other circumstances proved that would support the jury's verdict?
I don't think there's anything outside of the document.
But what about the fact that the jury had a chance to observe your client at trial? I mean, what was his age, for example, at the time of the trial? How old was your client?
I don't have his precise age in mind. He's in his 20s, I believe, but there was no evidence presented to the jury of a date of birth of Mr. Beasley. There's no date of birth on the record of adjudication either. So it simply refers to a child.
Would it be fair for a jury to infer, based on their observation of the client in court, that he would have been a juvenile in 2000?
I think that that's a reasonable inference, but I don't think that it precludes other rational inferences in this case. And all we have is that document. Mr. Beasley did not stipulate to the element of ineligibility. There were no questions asked of him. He didn't testify in the state. He didn't testify as to this issue.
Does it also matter, or is it also a circumstance proved that the prior adjudication occurred in Beltrami County, exactly where this trial proceeded?
That is reflected in the document, but I think that given the disparity in the names, the cases that talk about those types of factors in terms of where this took place already assume that there's some identity of names in play. And in this case, we don't have identity of names. We have a entirely different surname. We have a suffix of senior that, again, lends to the reasonableness of an inference that this is somebody other than Mr. Beasley. Because, again, family names are often used, especially when you have maybe a senior and somebody else who has the same first and middle names. So I think that that's an important piece of this analysis.
Would you agree that the name, even without any testimony on the subject, that a name as unique as Devion Liddell, with the spelling of both, and neither Devion or Liddell are particularly common names, and certainly putting the two together is exceptionally uncommon. Would you agree that if there is a reasonable hypothesis other than guilt, it would really have to be, and also given the location, it would really have to be the one that you suggested, which is that this is someone at best who is familiar with each other, if it's not the same person. Familiar meaning there's some likely familial relationship.
I think that's one example of another rational inference. I don't know that the jury had enough information to conclude, one way or another, that this was a familial I guess, to the exclusion of a rational inference that this wasn't somebody unrelated.
Was there any discussion about it? I mean, I saw the discussion in closing argument, but was there any information or discussion during the trial where evidence was presented or even argument made regarding the connection between the named individual in the adjudication and the defendant?
There was not, Your Honor. The state offered the Exhibit 21, without a witness. There was no testimony whatsoever. And as I said, Mr. Beasley did testify, but he was not asked any questions about any change of name, any addition of a suffix. He was not asked about the prior adjudication. So there was simply no evidence presented to the jury other than that heavily redacted single-page document.
And I think you've already mentioned it, but there was no reference to age, no suggestion that the person identified in the document had an age that was similar to your client.
Correct. There's no date of birth, and it's very broad language. It refers to the child. Doesn't provide the names of the parents that are referred to.
So we don't know whether this is a 7-year-old or a 17-year-old that's in reference in the document.
Exactly, Your Honor. That information is just simply not presented to the jury. If the court's okay, I would like to sort of return to the jury instruction issue. And I think where we left off on that topic was what the district court didn't say in analysis. And what the district court didn't say was that it was considering what a reasonable jury could conclude when viewing the evidence in the light most favorable to Mr. Beasley. The district court said I clearly would find that he might have been the aggressor. And that is, you know, quite similar actually to statements of the district court in an opinion issued just this week, State versus Luby, where the court reversed and remanded on a jury instruction question because the district court didn't view the evidence in the light most favorable to the appellant. So here we have the court making its own determination about what its view of the evidence would be. We also see this when
in terms of the self-defense instruction. I mean, the first element of self-defense is the absence of aggression on the part of the defendant. And here, I mean, the district court pointed out, what I think was clear from the video, and that is that your client got out of the car, then went back, took off his jewelry, which I think the police officer testified was, you know, consistent with preparing for, you know, a fight. Was there contrary evidence that the district court weighed on that point? And if not, why was it inappropriate for the court on that sole element to say this self-defense is unreliable?
There was contrary evidence on that point. And while he was present there and exited his vehicle, Mr. Beasley's testimony was that he did not know these other two individuals, Mr. Robertson and Mr. Tillotson, were going to be at the gas station. He did not intend he didn't go there intending to fight. He didn't want to fight. He was perhaps concerned about Mr. Robertson's appearance, but his statement to police when he was interviewed and that was played for the jury, he said, you know, we had some words and I told him, you know, we don't need to do this here. We don't need to fight, essentially. And so I don't think that given those circumstances, again, viewing the evidence in the light most favorable to Mr. Beasley, that's enough to say that he's an aggressor and to have a jury determine that particular question. Yes, there's evidence in the record that's contrary to Mr. Beasley's view, but at this point, at this juncture in the inquiry, the question has to be viewing it in Mr. Beasley's favor. Could a rational jury conclude that he wasn't the aggressor and there is evidence of that? The district court itself said he might have been the aggressor. But if he might have been the aggressor, he might not have been. And that is the precise question that the jury needed to be asked to decide. So even considering the district court's own reasoning on that point, it number one fails to comply with the sort of initial rules that we ask district courts to follow when they're determining these questions of whether the defendant is entitled to the jury instruction in the first place. But then the reasoning itself is inconsistent with what the defendant needs to show to bring that question before the jury. The district court continued to do this in the course of its analysis on the issue of necessity. The district court essentially determined that it felt that Mr. Beasley returned to the vehicle and to obtain a weapon before he ever saw Mr. Tillotson. This is contrary to Mr. Beasley's testimony. It's contrary to the testimony of an eyewitness, Mr. Olson, who said that he went to the car to get the gun for protection, that it was after Mr. Tillotson struck him that he retrieved the gun. So again, we have the district court just discrediting Beasley's testimony in a way that's impermissible. And that's why the district court abused its discretion here. And I think that this is also, you know, consistent with this court's decision also earlier this week in State versus Roloff. We have a very similar situation in terms of the type of underlying charge and the district court's failure in this context to view the evidence in the light most favorable to the defendant. This also was harmful error. This was Mr. Beasley's defense. We don't know if the jury rejected his evidence or did not know what to do with it. And the state has not actually argued on appeal that if error, it was harmless. And so that issue, I believe, has been waived. If the court doesn't have any further questions, I would just reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you. You will have 5 minutes of rebuttal time. Counsel for the state.
Thank you and good morning. May it please the court, this is Mike Malin for respondent. The state here is asking that this court uphold the district court decision and find that the evidence was sufficient to find Mr. Beasley guilty of the crime charged. The state would also indicate that the district court level did not abuse its discretion in denying the requests. And finally, the state would be asking this court to deny Mr. Beasley's request for a new trial because those instructions were not denied in an abuse of power and because the prosecutor did not commit error.
Can I have you begin with the same big picture that I had counsel for Mr. Beasley begin with, which is, I guess, a broad question. What do you see as the difference, the fundamental difference between direct evidence and circumstantial evidence?
Your Honor, from the state's perspective, as it relates to the certified copy of the adjudication.
No, I'm just asking you for a general definition. What is circumstantial evidence as compared to direct evidence?
Your Honor, from the state's perspective, circumstantial evidence would be extra or outside clues or indicators that offer inferences. Direct evidence would be obviously photographs of a suspect doing something or eyewitness account versus footprints in the snow, which is the common, I guess, example that we see.
So you would agree that the Supreme Court's definition of circumstantial evidence is the one that we should apply here, which is evidence that requires an inference in order to draw a conclusion on a probative fact is circumstantial evidence.
From the state's perspective, I think that both are at play here. We have.
No, I'm just asking you whether you agree that that's the definition of circumstantial evidence.
I would agree, Your Honor.
And your brief on a number of occasions makes the point that in order for the jury to conclude that Mr. Beasley, the defendant, was the same person named Mr. Schrady in the adjudicated document, would require inferences on the jury's part. The jury could not reach that conclusion directly looking at the document. Would you agree with that?
I wouldn't completely agree with that, Your Honor, because as I've indicated in my brief, his first and middle name are on that document.
Right, and a lot of people have the same first and middle name, but the last name is not the same, and there's no suffix designating the seniority. So in what logical scheme would a differently named individual, would a document that contains a different name be direct evidence that the defendant has that same name? If no, you're suggesting that the jury doesn't have to draw any inferences at all to reach that conclusion?
No, Your Honor. I would agree that inferences certainly need to be drawn, but
okay,
I think that
so we're talking about circumstantial evidence. So what was the circumstantial evidence presented to the jury? What was the, or I should put it a different way, what was the argument made to the jury to draw the connection between the named individual and the defendant in the case?
In terms of verbal argument offered to the jury, I suppose the statement in closing was the only argument offered as it relates
Well, that wasn't an argument. That was just a statement. That was a declaration that they're one and the same. But was there any presentation made to the jury that the, you can infer that they're one and the same because they're from the same county, they're the same age, they have the same date of birth? Was there any evidence to support such an argument, and was any argument ever made either during the trial or during the evidence presentation and during the argument? So why isn't it at least reasonable that the named individual and the defendant are perhaps related in the same family, share the same first and middle name, but different last names? Why isn't that a reasonable inference?
I think that the more reasonable inference is not that.
Right, the more reasonable inference might be something else, but that's not the circumstantial evidence standard. Under the circumstantial evidence standard, we ask whether there is any other reasonable inference, one that supports something, a conclusion other than guilt. So my question is, before I ask this, I don't want to assume that you believe that there's that it's unreasonable. I'll just ask you, do you agree that that is a reasonable hypothesis, that an individual who has the same name and first and middle name but different last name with no suffix of senior or junior is related to but not necessarily the same individual?
Not in this context, Your Honor.
So it's not reasonable at all?
Not within the context of this trial in this case.
Okay, what theory is that not reasonable? Explain why it's not reasonable. By the way, I should tell you, I know lots of people who have the same first name and first and middle name but different last name because they're named after a family member. So explain why it's not, and I assume you do too, but explain why it's that scenario is not reasonable in this case.
Your Honor, because the document was provided in this case, it's a self-authenticating certified document of an adjudication. There was no rebuttal as to that identity.
So the defendant has the burden of disproving?
No, Your Honor, but in this context, of the case, there was no other reasonable alternative.
Right, I'm asking you why.
And from the state's perspective, that would be based on the circumstances of the case.
What would the circumstances of the case have to do with whether their name, the named individual, is the same as the defendant? What were the, I'm asking, what were the circumstances of the case that would lead to the, that being the only conclusion?
Your Honor, from the state's perspective, because that document was provided in this trial, and it was the defendant's first and middle name, and it was in the same county that it took place in.
Okay.
Are you arguing that the first and middle name being the same is an identity of names as our case law defines
it? I am making that argument, Judge.
And what are the strongest support you have for that argument?
I apologize, Judge. I couldn't catch that last part.
I'm just saying, what case law supports, what's your strongest support for that assertion?
Well, Your Honor, my strongest support for identity of names being found here is in West. But as I've indicated in my brief, that it's very minimal, that case is. And so really Block, granted it's a foreign jurisdiction, it's a, not a Minnesota case, but they do analyze West. And I believe that they develop the record very well as it relates to how identity of names is found. And I believe that this case is follows in those parameters, and that identity of names was found here more than it was found in West, in which we're talking about three different names, aliases, and no further evidence being provided.
In what way do you find this case and Block to be factually materially the same?
Your Honor, in terms of more so the analysis of identity of names, I guess, is where the state finds that Block is most on point. And that would be as it relates to what Block describes as being used for establishing that identity, or for a jury to aid in determining identity. And that would be the fact that there are, while it is only the first and middle name, there are common commonalities there. There's
in Block, I believe the named individual and the defendant had the same first and last name. Is your recollection of that case the same?
I would have no reason to dispute that, Your Honor.
Okay. Were you able to find any case in the country where you have a different last name and from between the defendant and an individual named in a document where the court found identity, mutual identity?
West would be that case, Judge.
And what were the facts of West that lead you to that conclusion?
The facts of the of West that lead me to that conclusion is the fact that the defendant's name was Alvin West, and the, I believe it was prior certified documents for enhancement purposes, and those were named as Joe Plummer and Harry Weldon.
As I understand the case, the Supreme Court made it clear that when it was discussing identity of names, the defendant's actual name was Harry Weldon, and the name appearing on the conviction records was also Harry Weldon. Do you recall that case differently from what I've just described?
Your Honor, I certainly agree with the fact that the court found that Harry Weldon was the defendant's true name. I believe that one of the prior convictions was in a different name.
I believe the Supreme Court was analyzing that the conviction records indicated Harry Weldon and that the defendant's true name was Harry Weldon. But in our case, I think you've acknowledged, for some reason, the state did not introduce any evidence at all as to the defendant's name ever being Schrady, or it being his, quote, true name, or anything close to the facts of the West case. So I guess I'm going back to Judge Bjorkman's question. Besides the cases that you've named, was there any case that you have found anywhere where the court analyzed individuals who have a different first and last name from the name in the document attempting to establish identity?
No, Your Honor.
Were you trial counsel in this case, or was it a different trial counsel?
I was.
Maybe it's outside the record, but is there some reason why the Moore wasn't discussed at trial about the individual named and the defendant and relationship between the names, including dates of birth or other potential unifying characteristics?
I have no other information to offer on that.
Would you agree that the document might show that the named individual in the adjudication records might have been 7 years old or 17 years old or any age in between at the time of the adjudication based on the document by itself?
In terms of it being reasonable to believe that it could be any of those numbers?
Yes.
His date of birth is not listed in that document.
Okay.
And just for the court, I'm fine with answering any more questions. I have nothing more in terms of argument to offer.
Looks like there are no more questions. Thank you, Mr. Malin. Counsel for Mr. Beasley, any rebuttal?
Thank you, Your Honor. I do have a couple of items I want to address in rebuttal.
And just for the record, if you could please again state your name. We're only keeping an audio recording. We're not keeping the video recording, so all the little name designations won't appear.
Yes, thank you for the reminder, Judge. This is Leah Graff, once again, on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Beasley. I think that the court is analyzing West correctly. The question in West was a sufficiency question, and the court noted in the course of analysis that there was evidence of the true name of the appellant in that case. Certainly that's a fact that the court had to consider in a sufficiency claim and would only properly consider if there was evidence of the true names. I think that the state's sort of interpretation of West would be sort of untenable. You know, the state talked about commonality of names, but West doesn't say commonality. West says identity. The court is correct in State versus Block, the Wisconsin case. The evidence was of Larry Block, and the appellant was Larry Block. So there we have identity of names, and Block lays out other factors to consider. They sort of do that in corroborating that already established identity of names, which is lacking here for the reasons that have been discussed.
Counsel, was there any evidence presented here about other family members with similar names in the Beltrami, the Midge family?
I don't believe there was evidence presented of that question, but I don't think that changes the analysis here.
How the inferences have to be somehow tied to the evidence that is presented in the case?
Well, I think that is the question. And the question is, what did the state prove, and what are the reasonable inferences? And I think for the reasons that have been discussed, there isn't sufficient evidence to preclude another rational inference, and it's not on Mr. Beasley to to introduce evidence when the evidence that the state submitted is by itself insufficient.
Right, but I think Judge Bjorkman is asking whether it is in order for us to assume that there's some other reasonable inference, don't we have to draw that reasonable inference from material in the record and not just speculate about what some other hypothesis might, some evidence that might support some other hypothesis?
I think that the evidence in the record itself supports the other hypothesis. We ask juries in closing instructions to use their reason and common sense when they're determining whether the state has met its burden. And here, doing so, there remains this well-founded other rational inference as to who the person in the adjudication was.
Right, but you had suggested the rational inference would be because of the uniqueness, the apparent uniqueness of Devian and Liddell and the two combined, that the most reasonable hypothesis other than guilt would be a family connection of some type. But why would we infer that possibility existing if there's nothing in the record to suggest that was the case here, that this is a family that names individuals first and middle the same as other members of the family?
And I don't think there needs to be particular evidence of that fact for the inference to be reasonable. And there was evidence that Mr. Beasley's family was at least involved. His cousin was named DeJounte, and he was not a witness, but was referred to. And actually, when Exhibit 21 was submitted to the jury, the state referred to it as referring to DeJounte Straub rather than to Davion Schrady or Davion Beasley. So I think that there is, that the question has to be, was the state's evidence sufficient? And I think that when you look at that, there are rational inferences other than guilt without further evidence.
Are you suggesting that naming someone after a family member in the first or middle or both names is a common enough experience that no evidence needs to be presented that was going on in this particular family?
Exactly, Judge. That's what I've been trying to articulate, and you've captured it better than I was able to. So yes, that is precisely the issue.
Well, I see that you are out of time. Thank you to both counsel for your briefing in this matter and for your oral argument today and for accommodating our COVID concerns by participating in our online platform. We do appreciate your arguments very much. Thank you to both counsel. You both represent your clients very well. We have now concluded the matter. Therefore, the case is submitted. We've taken it under advisement, and we will issue our opinion within the statutory period. And therefore, we are in recess.